So welcome everyone. Thanks for coming along today. We've got about an hour and a half together. I know there are people still coming in, but I will get into it so we get as much out of this as possible. My aim today in this little discussion on working with trauma and family services is to just share some information. Some ideas of some how you can bring your skills to bear in this space in the most effective way possible, and also to give you a chance to talk to each other about kind of what it's like to work in this space, what you found works well, and what some of the challenges are. So I hope that you'll walk away with a really clear understanding of what's going on inside clients when they're experiencing trauma symptoms, what's happening for you when you're confronted with their reactions, what you can do in that space, and also an understanding of what's happening underneath that behavior for all of us. So I wondered if people could just start. I won't do a around the room intro because it will take up too much time. But if people are happy to just put your program and your organization in the chat, what kind of program you're working in, and feel free to add your pronouns if you'd like. I use he, him pronouns. And I didn't say my name's Ollie Doyle. I'm a counselor in private practice. And up until fairly recently, I've been working in the family services, family violence, and out-of-home care spaces in Bendigo, primarily a little bit in Queensland over the past 20 or so years. So we've got some people from BEDAC, Bendigo Community Health, KCLC, love that, some Orange Door peeps. In Bendigo, Haven Home Safe, Drummond Street. Yep, got some people from Drummond Street down Melbourne way. Cindy, hi Cindy from Sunbury. Fantastic. So we've got a range of people from a bunch of different spots. Yeah, just keep popping those in the chat. That's fantastic. Before we start, before I get into an acknowledgement of country, I just want to ask people, just take a second to turn off any notifications that you can turn off for the next hour and a half, where we're exploring how we engage with people in this space in a really respectful way, and how we kind of sit and be present with people who are in high levels of distress. So if you're able to turn off your notifications and just mute anything you can mute, that's going to just help you to engage in it in the best way that you can today. Also ask people to just take a second to grab a pen and paper if you can, and if you haven't got one nearby, because we will do a mix of some reflective writing exercises that are quick and simple, don't worry. Discussion in small groups and some bigger group discussion today, as well as me taking you through the information that I've got. If you've got questions as we're kind of rolling along, feel free to put them in the chat. I'm by myself and I'm doing a few things at once, so I might not see them, but hopefully we'll have a bit of time at the end to just ask questions as well. All righty, let me see. All right, so before we begin, just going to stop sharing for that. Before we begin, I just want to acknowledge that I'm broadcasting here from the traditional lands of the Dja Dja Wurrung people, lands that have never been ceded and that are still owned by the communities who've cared for them since forever. I want to acknowledge that we're talking about trauma and in this country, the history of invasion, of dispossession, and of marginalization of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples is right here. It's happening today. It doesn't, it's never stopped. And that when we're talking about trauma, we can't separate it from the abusive behaviors of systems and people who have power over others. So, in that spirit, I want to welcome any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who are here today or who are watching this later on to offer my apologies for the destruction that my ancestors have wrought on this land and its people, and for the privilege that I enjoy as a descendant of settlers who came to this country and invaded. I wonder if people could just put in the chat whose land you are currently sitting on. And if you're not sure, make a note for yourself to find out later on. But I'd love to see. I'm on Dja-Dja-Wrang country here. I would love to see. Got Jenny's on Yorta Yorta country. Yeah, I'd love to know where else people are broadcasting from or are joining from. And in that spirit, I would like to just take a moment to just sit in silence and to just commemorate the harms that have been done on this country. So, thank you, everyone. On that note, we are talking about trauma today, and that might bring up some difficult material for people who are here. So, this isn't a space where I'm going to ask you to share anything like that. But if it does trigger difficulties for you, please take care of yourself, and please feel free to check in or reach out afterwards if anyone's kind of distressed and wants to have a conversation about that. Okay. Yeah. I'm just going to share my screen again. Let's make that big. Beautiful. So, I want to just outline the way that we'll kind of work through the material today. So, we've got four sections that we're going to look at. And this is all revolving around trauma. So, the first one is what do you see when clients are distressed, when they're overwhelmed by trauma symptoms? The second part is what's happening underneath that, what's happening within the nervous system, what's happening within the brain. We'll have a bit of a look at that. What happens to you when you're sitting with someone or you're on the phone with someone and that trauma comes into the room? And how do we respond? How do we best respond as professionals and as, people who care? And I wonder, could people just pop in the chat? I know I'm asking you to do a lot of work already, but if you could just pop in the chat what you're hoping to get out of the session today, and I'll give you a little sentence starter that I'll know this conversation was worth attending if dot dot dot. So I'll know this conversation was worth attending if dot dot dot. So people are happy to just add their finished sentence or the end of their sentence to that. What do you want to walk away from today with? What are you wondering about? What are you hoping for? And this is a really important kind of question, because ideally it's the first question we want to ask when we're sitting with clients. So starting to think about that for ourselves can be a really useful process as well. All righty. So before we jump into what do you see, I want to just take a moment to explore kind of what health looks like, and then we can start to think about how a history of trauma might impact that. So this is a quote from Daniel Siegel, who some of you would probably be familiar with from a great book of his called The Mindful Therapist. You will get the notes after this, the slides after this, and I'll put a list of resources that I've quoted as well. So, we are filled with potential. Health, in many ways, can be seen as bathing in a wide open pool of possibility. Unhealth can be viewed as various rigid and chaotic ways we become unable to be present with this broad freedom. So, I want to do a little exercise together to just connect with this possibility inside us, this kind of open space, and to ground ourselves, to get a feel for where we want to work from when we're sitting with people. So people can maybe just sit quietly for a moment and just feel your breath. So just breathe out nice and slow. Breathe all the way out. And then just let your breath come back in. And then breathe out nice and slow. And let your breath come back in. And you might sense this kind of feeling of openness inside yourself. This feeling of kind of spaciousness, where there's feelings in your body, there's sensations in your body, there's thoughts coming and going. But there's this kind of steady sense of you there, observing all of that. So we could call that being grounded, being centered. And if we picture this moment as a river that we're drifting along, there's all kinds of rapids, there's all kinds of snags, there's all kinds of material in that river inside us. And sometimes we get stuck on one bank or the other, and we get stuck into these rigid patterns of responding that actually don't fit with who we want to be and don't help us to behave in the ways that we want to behave. So just keep feeling your breath, and I just want to talk through that a little bit. So trauma symptoms can trigger behavioral chaos. So we're talking about fight flight responses and or this kind of rigidity, shutdown, collapsed response in our clients and in ourselves as well. So when we kind of breathe and we get anchored in our bodies, we feel this kind of openness, this sense of possibility of I could respond in any way I choose. And when we get shut down by trauma responses or by our nervous system, then we only have a small number of options that we can fight, we can run away, or we can collapse. And so what we're going to look at today is how that kind of plays out within the work that you do and within your clients, and how we can respond to that in ways that help clients to open up to more freedom, to more possibility, to more openness. So I want to begin this exploration by getting clear, helping you to get clear about who do you want to be when you're sitting with a family in distress, when you're sitting with a person in distress. How do you want to show up? What qualities do you want to bring to bear within your work? Because we know that clients are going to show up how they show up. They're going to respond how they respond, and probably our nervous systems are going to do what they do. We can't control those things. But what we can start to exert control over is what qualities we bring into our interactions and into our work. So to do that, I want you to just grab your pen and paper, and I'm just going to take you through some cards that I use with families and people who've done supervision with me will be familiar with these cards, will have used them before. One second, screen sharing is my Achilles heel. All righty. Okay, so these are called Choosing Strengths cards. And oops. And so each card has a strength on it. For example, I can choose to be curious. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to flick through these cards one at a time. And I want you to just on your pen and paper, just pick two or three, if you can narrow it down, that represent how you want to show up, who you want to be when you're sitting with people in distress. So, qualities you want to bring to your work with trauma survivors. All right, I'm just going to flick through these a few seconds each. That one's committed. I'll read out some because they're a little hard to read on devices. I think that's a glitch. Think my card stopped loading halfway through. So I hope you only needed 27 options because I think that's all you're going to get. All right, so take a moment to just have a look at the words that you've written there, because we're gonna come back to those throughout the session, because it's my proposal that instead of trying to control our feeling states and what's going on inside us, that we're much better placed if we put our attention into how we want to respond when difficult material shows up and when we're feeling empathy, upset, overwhelm, and that holds for ourselves and also for the people that we serve. So let me jump back into. So I just want to share the kind of stance that I have in this work and kind of where I'm coming from. And that is that clients, as well as ourselves, are searching for ways to control or eliminate trauma symptoms, which we could also just call emotional distress. And my position, which I want to lay out really clearly, is that emotional control isn't the solution to our problems, that it is the problem itself. So, it's a quote from Patty Robinson and Kirk Strossel that emotional control isn't the solution, it's the problem. In order to gain the illusion of control over painful experiences, the client must sacrifice living a vital life. The irony is that painful experiences can't be controlled or eliminated in the first place, and that attempts at control are what actually makes painful experiences even more painful. So if we think about how this translates within the client experience and within ourselves, what we're saying, or what I'm saying, is that clients come to us with a trauma history that they've experienced. They've seen, heard, and experienced things that have overwhelmed their nervous system, and that they've had to develop certain coping strategies in order to survive. And those survival responses are completely logical, reasonable, adaptive ways to cope with other people treating you in ways that are awful. The problem is that when we seek to control how trauma shows up, how trauma symptoms show up in our present moment, we can only do that by doing things to suppress those feelings, by doing things to numb out, or by acting out in ways that soothe us in the short term, but create bigger life problems. And if you look at parents you're working with in the child protection system, if you look at people who are, struggling with substance abuse issues, if you look at anyone that you're probably working with today, you'll see that they have a range of things that they do in order to manage their emotional distress. And they have a range of things that they avoid also to manage that emotional distress. So, the work that I draw from is the work of Judith Herman, who wrote Trauma and Recovery, and who clarified, probably for the first time in Western psychology, that when we're working with trauma survivors, we're not trying to remove or repattern the traumatic event itself. We're trying to help them cope with the things that show up in their life in the present moment because of those experiences. And that's what we're kind of going to continue to work through today. So I'm just going to take a moment to just check the chat. So people looking for ways to support staff better, new skills and approaches, empower young people that have traumatic experiences. Yeah, that's a huge piece of work and so important. Strategies for working with families, help clients identify triggers. Yes, we're definitely going to get into that. gain more knowledge for working with families. I sure hope you do from this. And engaging topics of a sensitive nature for clients by learning new skills through trauma-informed practice. Yeah, I love all that. So you're all in the right place. We're going to jump into breakout rooms. We're well, not jump, but move into breakout rooms in a moment. First of all, maybe one more screen share. Okay, so emotional control isn't the solution, it's the problem. So I'm going to suggest that it's our goal when working with trauma survivors to promote flexible responses to trauma that are in line with a client's hopes, dreams, and values. And this was why I asked you to identify some qualities that you want to embody in your work. Because those are your hopes, dreams, and values for your work with people. And I'll in a little bit, I'll take you through a client example that digs into this a little bit more. But basically, we want people when painful memories come up, when difficult feelings come up, we're kind of saying that it's a given that that's going to happen. And we're saying to people, what do you want to do? How do you want to show up as a parent, as a person, as a human being when those things are present inside you? Who do you want to be? How do you want to stand in the presence of trauma? So I hope that's a kind of helpful way to conceptualize what we're trying to do. If our goal was to just get rid of the symptoms, that's what clients are largely trying to do anyway. But we know that that's not an effective way to build a life that people really value and care about. Alrighty. I'm going to leave the screen share up, but does anyone want to say anything at this point? If anyone wants to unmute yourself and question, comment.
I just wanted to say I'm enjoying the sort of reflective way we're working through this. It's a good way to practice, I feel.
Okay, thanks, Jenny. Let's appreciate that. That will continue and maybe just think about if there's questions you might want to explore with a client or with someone in supervision. You just make a note of those as we go as well. Thanks, Jenny. Anyone else want to share a question? Cool. All right, I'll get you to grab your pen and paper. And the first thing that we're going to explore is like, what do you see when clients are overwhelmed, when trauma is kind of running the show inside their body, their brain, their life? What do you see? So I'm going to just give you 30 seconds or so after you've read the question. To just write some, just scribble some dot points of what behaviors you notice when clients are overwhelmed. And once you've had time to just jot a few things down, I'll put us into breakout rooms and we'll just have, 5 or 10 minutes to just explore with a few people who are kind of fighting the same fight as you, what things you're noticing, like when a client's on the phone. So I know some of you are primarily working in that space, or when someone comes into your office or you go out to their house. What do you see? What do you notice them doing? when they're overwhelmed. So I'll give you just 30 seconds to jot some things if you haven't already. Yikes. Right. So, welcome back. I think I hope everyone's back. So next, I just wanted to take a moment to just capture any any themes or anything that kind of stood out from your groups. So if people want to just unmute yourselves and just share, you know, what were some of the things that you were talking about, some of the behaviors, some of the patterns that were kind of common across your group or that stood out?
Our group, I suppose it's probably going to be similar to a lot of the groups. Just what we've seen, we saw, we see in the voices getting louder. I've just got voices louder, eyes wider, talking more or talking less, or just a change in appearance, a change in being able to take information in and give information out, teary, aggressive, and there was a lot of other good examples in the group if anyone else wants to add
And
on.
struggling to make a decision about something that would appear to be quite a simple decision to make, but they're unable to. It's
Yeah.
like being stuck in a brown paper bag and not being able to get out of it. Do you know? Have you heard that saying?
Yeah.
Like, paper is very easy to rip, but people can't get to a state they can't actually make that decision or do something.
Yeah, so there's a kind of sense of overwhelm. You kind of see that the brain's not working in the way that it could, that simple decisions become really complex for them. And there's this almost like panic, sort of panicky feeling about making those small decisions. And if we think back into trauma history, like people's trauma history or what we know of it, they're in a way their system's been wired to say, like, one wrong move and you might be killed, essentially. Like one wrong move in a relationship or in a family dynamic, and your body and your brain is saying you're at risk of death if you do the wrong thing. So when these symptoms are triggered in people, it do, you know, it does become very closed. And the best example I've heard is if you imagine a rabbit just out grazing in the field, that's a bit of a trigger for me because my daughter's got two female rabbits and one of them just had babies last week. So we've got 10 rabbits now. Thanks, Pet Shop. But if you imagine a rabbit just out grazing in the field and there's nothing threatening it, and it's just cruising around, just maybe looking around, smelling the air, and then all of a sudden, you know, a big cat comes into view, then the rabbit's vision narrows to the predator or the threat, the escape, which is the burrow, and that's all it sees. And all of its energy is condensed and pushed down that channel of escape and survive. And so when people are triggered even by small things, we can kind of get a feel for inside that. There's this there's this escape avoidance behavior being triggered, or there's this fight behavior being triggered. And so the context, like what's happening in the environment, doesn't matter too much because their whole system is moving into this just how do I get away from danger, even if there's no danger present. Does that make sense? Sort of, yeah. And does that kind of, I guess, how does that fit with what else people are describing? What else is coming up in groups?
I think for us in our group, we discussed the fact that when there's all these triggers happening, and so for example, in some other programs that we work, clients come and set up goals that they want to achieve, whether it's parenting support or things like that. And when there's all these trigger, it's about, because then they tend to engage more when there are all these triggers in terms of need reassurance and stuff like that. But then when there's no triggers, the engagement is not as much. So then we end up not originally supporting them in what they wanted, but really just being present for the for all this, which is, fine. But I guess it's about finding how we can still do that whilst at the same time supporting them in achieving those goals, because then that will give them empowerment in terms of, despite all this, I still achieve that.
Yeah, that's a really good point, that if we're just kind of soothing people in the moment, that's a good starting point. But if that's all we do with clients, that's, in a way, that's okay. But we want to look for how do we help them beyond that single interaction, make changes in the way they respond to distress so that they can have more choice and achieve the things they want to achieve in their life. Because it, like as you're saying that, it's like, I'm sure a lot of you have this thought, as I did when I was a family worker, of I'm here for an hour and a half. It was probably a week back then. It's probably a fortnight for you all now, I guess. And what, how do I kind of help shape what happens the rest of the time, given the tiny little bit of influence I've got, and that calming someone might help for today or a few hours, and definitely we should start there. But how do we kind of step beyond that into helping them make independent change that they have agency over? Yeah, that's a really good point. Anything else that kind of stood out in groups that you think worth sharing? I'm sure there's kind of heaps. Can pop stuff in the chat as well if you if you'd rather do it there. Alrighty. So I'm just gonna jump back into the slides. Hopefully. Thank you. So, what do we notice? So, we've been talking about trauma as kind of one homogenous thing, I suppose. But I just want to separate that there's a couple of different kind of categories of trauma responses. And it's useful to kind of to get a feel for which one clients might be stuck in at different times, because they look quite different. So the first one, we've probably all heard of, like this fight flight capacity of our nervous system, and people have kind of talked about this, the speaking rapidly, jumping from topic to topic. So this can make it really hard to have a solid conversation with someone if every sentence is about something different. It's really hard to pin the conversation down. I don't know if that was certainly one of my experiences working with people in this space, and still is. Scanning for danger. So you might see people almost looking over your shoulder, looking around a lot. I've got one client who I see over video call who spends most of the session sort of looking beyond the screen, and it's just a habitual behavior of scanning for danger. You might notice shallow breathing if you're with them in person, so that if you watch a person's breath rate, how deeply they're breathing, you'll see this kind of pattern of shallow breathing that's we know is increasing anxiety and making people's bodies more distressed. You might see fidgeting, you might see pacing. So, people who struggle to sit still, people who struggle to kind of engage in a conversation. On the flip side, if I can find my cursor. On the flip side, we've got these other behaviors that are connected with kind of nervous system collapse. So, sorry, my system's going a bit haywire. Just give me one second. Apologies. So we have this on the flip side, we've got this kind of freeze collapse response that's connected with the parasympathetic nervous system, which polyvagal theory is a really useful kind of space to explore if you're doing this kind of work. And so we might see people zoning out, that they're quite slumped, they're kind of their body posture's almost collapsed, that there's a lack of motivation, maybe lack of interest in the conversation, and maybe agreeing with whatever you suggest. And sometimes, people often talk when I do supervision around clients agreeing to things in a session, having the resources to do it, and then going away and not following through. And the last one there, agreeing with whatever you suggest, that's a really important one to watch out for because sometimes in particularly in child protection type scenarios, this becomes confused with that they're on board, they're engaged, they're on the same page as us, they understand the concerns, they know kind of what needs to happen. When in fact they may just be kind of tuned out and agreeing with whatever you suggest. And this can also come up with for people who work with young people as well, that they kind of get the feel that the meetings go quicker if they agree to stuff. So if they're in care team meetings or they're meeting with you, they might just say what they know you want to hear and then get out the door and they can get back to life a lot quicker. So there's some of the things that we might see. It's a little kind of polyvagal diagram that's kind of nice and bright and crazy. So we've got that freeze response up the top, and I'll dig into that a little bit more in a moment. We've got the fight flight kind of in the middle, and down the bottom, this kind of, I call it social engagement system, which is hopefully kind of where our bodies are now, that we're kind of, we feel safe, we feel relaxed, and we can kind of have a conversation and learn and share and connect with other people. Any comments or thoughts, questions in that space before next part, we'll kind of look at what's happening underneath for people. But just want to check in if there's anything else that you want to share or ask about. All right, so what's going on underneath all of this? We're seeing these either fight, flight, or collapse behaviors. We're seeing clients kind of spinning their wheels, stuck in the same patterns that aren't working for them. So what's going on underneath that? So put really, this is really condensed and simple, that in this fight flight mode, our body's kind of flooded with energy chemicals to either escape or fight back. And I know this won't be new to people. So we think about it from an evolutionary perspective. Underneath our language brain, our that makes us think we're so great as humans, is all the parts of the impala and the grizzly bear. We've got this mammalian brain underneath. So do we run away or do we fight? If this fails, or if escape is doesn't seem like the best option for our nervous system, then we collapse into this freeze state, or also called fawn, where we basically just play dead. So apologies if anyone's scared of snakes. Meant to trigger you. So in this collapsed state, so if we think about it, the body moves into fight flight. Builds up all this energy to respond, and then it can't. So it collapses. So all this energy that's been built up is still there within the system, within the body. And this has been kind of the breakthrough of trauma therapy over the last probably 30, 40 years, is that if we don't process the trauma energy that's still in the body now, that it gets stuck. This is from Peter Levine's book, Waking the Tiger. So, a threatened human or impala must discharge all the energy mobilized to negotiate that threat, or it will become a victim of trauma. This residual energy doesn't go away, it stays in the body and forces the formation of a wide variety of symptoms, which are the organism's way of containing the energy that's been built up. Levine makes a really good point as well, that we're one of the few animals that are sometimes prey and sometimes predator historically. And so our systems can get confused as well about which way to go. So we can get into this muddle where an impala is just going to run away. It's not going to decide whether to it can take on the whether it can take on the cheetah or not. It's just going to run as fast as it can. Alrighty. Now, so I'm just going to share a client example of this, just to kind of illustrate what I'm talking about. And I'm just conscious, like we're a little tight on time, which I expected. But if we don't get through all this today, we can come back another day. But I do want to get, I will move a little quicker so we can get to the practical bits, because I don't want to spend your whole time on. On this. Alrighty. So this is a client that I worked with recently, and this is just something I use. I do diagramming with clients to get a sense of what's happening inside the experience of being traumatized, and how it's kind of affecting their life. So just really simply, this person witnessed their child being assaulted, which understandably provoked anxiety and panic, and then self-critical thinking because they thought they hadn't protected their child in the way that they could have. And it's a classic thing where they could see that that wasn't the case, but it didn't stop the thoughts. It didn't stop the anxiety. This was then creating a sense of panic for them, and they were responding to the panic by exhibiting controlling behavior towards their family. Now, in this instance, I'm not talking about like abusive controlling behavior. I'm talking about like over managing people, trying to keep the house just perfect, trying to make sure everyone was happy. And then when people didn't respond to that the way this person wanted, then they were responding with anger. They were getting angry at people in the family. So in a sense, whenever thoughts connected to the assault came up, this triggered the feelings, which then triggered her nervous system, which then triggered the behaviors that were kind of out of alignment with her values. So one way we can kind of picture this is that, well, this is kind of the same diagram, but I've expanded the circles to show what the client was focused on when they came in, which was obviously this recent assault was front and center, and their panic, their anxiety, their self-critical thoughts. They wanted help to control those. And these behaviors that were coming out of it, I had to dig for a little bit. So my view on it was a little bit different. And as we explored it, they kind of came to this themselves that the real problem was that when they were feeling these feelings of hurt and upset and panic, that they were then responding to that in ways that didn't fit kind of who they wanted to be. So with that person, we just did some practice, sitting with the feelings, opening up to the feelings, allowing space for those feelings to kind of come and be acknowledged and accepted. And then they found, like, within a session, that it kind of shifted into this space. So there was whenever the memory of the assault was triggered, it generated a warm feeling of love for their children, their family. And we couldn't say that the anxiety and the panic or these behaviors weren't part of their life anymore, but they weren't connected to this memory in the same way. So I'm sharing this because it's a kind of neat, simple example. It's where I got to work with someone a few weeks after the event had happened. It hadn't kind of been locked into a pattern of behavior, and they didn't have trauma on trauma on trauma over generations that they were trying to kind of deal with. But it highlights how changing the way someone responds to a feeling or a memory or a distressing experience can significantly reshape their life in a pretty short space of time. So I was going to do breakout rooms for the next part, but instead we'll just go into a little bit of reflection for yourself. So if you just grab your pen and paper again, and the next couple of questions is about what happens for you when you're sitting with someone who's experiencing this high level of distress and your buttons are getting pushed by that trauma. So just going to ask that question. So just again, take 30 seconds to just think about what physical sensations, what emotions, what reactions do you experience when you're sitting with a client who's stuck in this fight flight elevation? Just take 30 seconds for that. And just another 30 seconds. What physical sensations, emotions, reactions do you experience when a client is stuck in this collapse space? So when they just are zoned out, lacking motivation, they can't quite bring their effort to the table. What happens for you in that space?
Well, I want to motivate them.
Yeah,
For the talk.
you might become too proactive.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we want to just get a feel for like what happens for you in that space. And want to come back now to those things that you wrote down earlier about the qualities that you want to embody in your work. Just have a look back on your list of those things that are important to you that you want to kind of live and breathe inside your work. And then think about, I think of a time when your reactions to a client's trauma behaviors got in the way of being the worker that you want to be. So just take another 30 seconds, just think about that. Just remember a time when someone kind of pushed your buttons and it took you out of that space. I just want to share this quote around this space because I think it's relevant to all of us as humans, our clients and ourselves, that as patterns of emotional situational avoidance widen, people lose their bearings in life and fall out of contact with positive vitality producing behaviors. And their life space constricts as their emotional control agenda takes over. So if you just think back on that situation and how your inner reactions and your desire to kind of to control those change the way that you responded to that client. I wonder if we can just take a moment to just write down three things we think about. Behaviors that you want to bring into every session with people, ways that you want to be. Yeah, three things that you would do if you could have that interaction again and just bring your best self to it. So just take a moment to kind of write down when I'm sitting, if I was sitting with this person again, I'd want to, and maybe it's as simple as stay curious. Listen carefully. Remember to breathe. Just write down a few things as we continue through. And I wonder. Does anyone feel comfortable to kind of share their example of that moment when you kind of lost who you want to be inside that? Inside that trauma response?
I suppose it's happened when I've worked with perpetrators of family violence, and they've sort of been escalated a little bit, and I've sort of been thinking about safety, which we keep in mind anyway, but thinking about, okay, when do we leave? What do we do? That sort of thing. And one of the three things. Grounding myself may have been helpful at that stage, and maybe more, as you said, being more curious about that reaction and bringing it back to the children and just working through that with him possibly may have been useful.
Yeah, that's a really good example of, I think, anyone who sits with perpetrators or people who use violence, you kind of experience that all the emotions at once, and plus there's realistic concerns about your own safety. And I like that focus. What we're looking at here is how do I respond rather than what's the client going to do in response to me. But that's a really good example. All right. So we're nearly at the pointy end. Let me share this again. So these are some ways that we kind of avoid experience that are common to all humans when we're in distress. And I won't go through those now because you can have a look at them in the slides. But essentially, we're trying to keep, stop from thinking about difficult things, stop from feeling emotions that are hard, and behaviorally trying to move ourselves away from distressing circumstances, which kind of fits with that example of wanting to pull away from the client when we feel this level of distress. The next thing is, like, what can we do about it? And this is kind of where this is the kind of critical part, is it's great to have all this knowledge, but what are we going to do with it? The first thing that I think is really important is to just recognize your response as normal and healthy. So your nervous system and your brain is trying to keep you safe, trying to make sure that you do your best work. And when we sit with someone who is in a state of dysregulation, our systems are wired to kind of pick up on that. So if you imagine, we lived in small bands out in the wild, and one of the ways that we checked for safety was by looking to other people. And you see this in all kind of herd mammals that, one of them reacts to something and they all react automatically. And that's kind of baked into us. So we can't kind of turn off our nervous system response to people being dysregulated. Nor would we want to, because it's a survival mechanism. It's really important. So the first thing is to just, if we just kind of acknowledge that that's how we're wired and that's healthy and good, that's a nice starting point. Second thing is to regulate ourselves. So if we're getting caught up in our distress, we're not going to be able to be present for the client or for ourselves. So it's kind of four things that I recommend in this space that are kind of really simple. The first one is actually not that simple, but it's very doable. Let's develop dual awareness. So in therapeutic work, we call dual awareness being able to listen to the client, tune into them, their body language, and feel inside our own body, notice our own thoughts and feelings at the same time. So a lot of people in our kind of work are so engaged in trying to listen to the client, trying to be attuned, trying to pick up on what they're saying and be curious, that we almost move out of our own experience and become totally immersed in the client's experience. And that's a really useful skill to have. But if we need to have awareness of our reactions so that we can modulate them. So that's a kind of first step is, and you can kind of practice that when you're just listening to colleagues or you're listening to your kids or your partner, is like, can I listen to them and be aware of what's happening inside me at the same time? And when you get a feel for that, it's pretty simple to do, but it does require a bit of practice and reminding yourself. Breathing is so important. We know that, but how you breathe makes a massive difference to your nervous system. So at the start, we did some like big, long, slow exhales. And if you do that now, you kind of you just feel and just let your body breathe in, you kind of feel a slowing down straight away. There's interesting research that they got clinicians to just take one full breath before responding to what clients said in a small study, and they found that the client experience changed significantly, and the clients didn't know what the workers were doing, but the quality of the work from the client's point of view increased just by one breath before responding. So I recommend just doing, 3 to 5 of those slow breaths before you walk into a visit or pick up the phone. Same again afterwards. And then just try to ch check in with your breathing during sessions as part of this dual awareness. Noticing is really important. We're kind of noticing all the time, but we can get overly caught up in the thoughts going through our minds and really seeing body language, seeing whether the client's breathing, noticing facial expressions, picking up on those details. You will kind of get your system, will keep your brain, your big brain engaged and online in a different way. The last one's observe beyond the story. So this is a little bit more tricky, but it just means when someone's telling you the story or telling you what's happened, also just consider what's the function of the story, what's the purpose of them telling you that story. So if someone's telling the same types of stories over and over again, what's the function of that? Does that help them self-soothe? Do they not feel listened to, and they're hoping that you're going to be the one who actually listens to them? Is it just their nervous system kind of running the show? So what's going on kind of inside the story? We're kind of wired as adult humans to get caught up in the content of the story, get caught up in the language. What does it mean? What do we do into problem solving? But if we can just take a breath and just consider, why is it important for this person to tell me this now? That can really help just kind of reshape the ways that we respond. So that's one kind of space. The second space is co-regulation, which people have probably heard of that, but it's what parents do for infants when there's healthy attachment. Is the infant's distressed, they get picked up, the parent's calm, that calms the infant. That helps to kind of teach them to self-soothe. We kind of know how this works. For the client, you can do that too. You don't have to hold them, luckily, boundaries, but you can do things to slow it down. So changing the pace. So I'll often interrupt someone's story, and then once I've got their attention, I just won't say anything for a few seconds. And then I'll just speak really nice and slowly and say, I was just wondering about this part of what you said. Or I'll even ask people, can you tell me that again, but just slow it down because I really want to catch it. So changing the pace of interactions is a great way to help people to rein in their own nervous system. Using wise self-disclosure. So this could be things like, I feel really sad hearing you say that. I'm noticing as you're telling your story, it feels really anxious inside me. What's happening for you? These kind of bits of sharing like your present moment experience with the person. And obviously you're all experts in boundaries around self-disclosure and how to use it wisely. So I'm not here to tell you about that. If you can leave tasks for even a few minutes and just focus on some grounding, which could be just helping people feel their feet on the floor, take a breath, slow down. Before we start, can we just take a minute to just check in? Can we just, you know, helping them look around the room, notice things? All of these things help bring their noticing system online and help kind of rein in that that nervous system response. And obviously you do this if you can, but provide practical support if you can. So if you're working with people with really reasonable distress around housing issues, around financial issues, around those kind of things, if we can kind of walk alongside people and provide practical support, that can make all the difference. And I just put empathize. I know that's a core skill set, core part of what you all do, but I think it can't be underestimated, the power of saying to someone, like, I see you, I hear you, and your distress is, you know, makes perfect sense in your circumstances. And lastly, kind of is debrief and reflect for yourself. So again, taking some time to breathe and stretch. Outside of visits, when we're thinking about clients' behavior, you know, let's apply that trauma and nervous system lens. Talk to your colleagues around it and take the time to ground yourself before the next interaction if you at all can. So, you know, simple body scans, simple breath awareness practices can really help to bring yourself down during those interactions. So essentially what I'm saying is the best way we can support clients is to be the kind of soothing, calm, grounded parent figure that they maybe never had or had sporadically, while we're sitting in the room with them, while we're witnessing their trauma play out in real time. And as a simple starting point, managing ourselves to help co-regulate them. We're right on time, right at the end of our time, sorry. I am going to be here for a little while longer. If people want to chat or run through client examples, I am hoping to do more of these in the future if there's appetite for those. So please pop in the chat if you'd be keen to do this again, if there are topics that you want to explore, if you want to explore this topic more, because I know we just scratched the surface today. I am developing a full-day training on this for a service up in the Mallee. So if anyone's interested in exploring that for yourself or your service, please reach out. As I said, I'm a counsellor in private practice, but my specialty area is working with trauma survivors within the family service system. So if you have clients that you want to talk through, if you've got external supervision needs for your teams or yourselves, or if you're interested in training opportunities, my details are there. You'll get these slides afterwards. I just want to check in before we do finish up. Yeah, we finished with 14 of us, so that was pretty good. And a few people had to drop off along the way. Hopefully they can catch up on the bits. But just want to thank people for your participation, your sharing, for kind of helping each other out and being a part of the conversation today. And I guess would anyone like to, I know if people need to go, that's okay, but if Does anyone want to share any reflections, anything that's kind of come up for you? Anything? I'm